Welcome to Parshas Beha'alosecha, 5768. We have just concluded a holiday of Shavuos, and in our class that means we have been anticipating. For 6 weeks, we focused on the event and the reaffirmation and the re-experiencing of the giving of the Torah. Where do we go from here? Now, looking at the Torah, we see a pattern developing, and unfortunately, it's not a pretty pattern. In this week's Parsha, beginning with chapter 11, and continuing on through the end of the Parsha, and into next week's Parsha, Shalach, and into next week's Parsha, Korach, the Torah is filled with incidents of problems. Problems and, we might say, character flaws. Or, as we say in Hebrew, or in colloquial Yinglish, bad midos, bad character traits. I refer to incidents such as the one in this week's Parsha. I'll read a few lines. Vayihi ha'om kemisonanim, ra ve'oznei Hashem. The beginning of chapter 11. The people took to seeking complaints. It was evil in the ears of Hashem, and Hashem heard and his wrath flared. Complaining. Just a few verses later, verse 4 of chapter 11. V'hasafsuf asher bekirbo hisavu ta'ava, v'yoshuvu v'yivku gam b'nei Yisrael v'yomru mi'achilenu basar. The rabble that was among them, the rabble meaning a group of tagalongs, the mixed multitude now showed its true colors. They succeeded in influencing the rest of the nation, the children of Israel, to complain again as they had done previously. This was a group of people from different nations that came to the Jewish people, said to Moshe, "We would like to join your ranks. We're impressed by your God. We're impressed by your people. We want to be one of you." And Moshe accepted them.
These were not Jews.
These were not Jews. Of course, nobody was Jewish yet officially because there had been no giving of the Torah. But these were from a mixed multitude of other nations. And Moshe accepted them, but throughout the 40 years in the desert, they were instigators of a lot of unrest, such as the golden calf, for example. They were in the forefront. And here again, with stirring up the bad blood, the complaints. Who will feed us meat? And they have influence. The children of Israel also wept, and they also said, "Who will feed us meat?" And they started complaining about the tasteless manna. So we see in this Parsha the beginning, the stirrings of dissatisfaction, of malcontent. In the next week's Parsha, we'll talk about it more next week and the following week, in the Parsha of Shalach is the infamous story of the spies who were sent by Moshe to spy out the land and hopefully come back with a report that the Jewish people would be taking over this beautiful land that was given to them by God. And yet, 10 out of the 12 spies came back with a negative and a disheartening report. What was the cause of that? The Zohar states that it was, once again, bad midos. It was a flaw in character. According to the Zohar, these tribal leaders feared for their position. They thought, and maybe it was true, that once the Jewish people would enter the land, there would be a different political structure. And they would no longer be the princes. And therefore, subconsciously or otherwise, they came back with a report that says, it's not good for us there. Yes?
But how can that be blamed on the Arab frog?
No, that wasn't. No, that was not by the Arab frog. But it's a display of poor character. Yeah. Yes, I'm sorry if I implied that.
And poor character is different from the evil inclination, how?
Well, I'm going to suggest that the next several weeks we're going to spend on discovering what does it mean, poor character. So let's leave that as a question. It is no doubt fed by the evil inclination. And in the next parsha after that, we have Korach, a high-ranking Levite who was jealous, our sages say. Rashi says he was jealous, even though he was a Levite, a very exalted member of the Jewish nation. But he wasn't the prince of his Levite family. Rather, it was a cousin. It was a cousin from a younger uncle than his father. And he felt slighted by that. And based on that, he created a movement of opposition to Moshe and to his authority, seeming to be the champion of justice, but really motivated by his own jealousy. What happened here? Where is this breakdown? We just received the Torah. We just built the tabernacle, the Mishkan, as we saw in Parshas Bamidbar. There was the picture of the ideal Jewish setting. Remember, that's our portrait of unity, of holiness, of building our lives, building our camp around God. How did that disintegrate into this display of poor character?
It didn't disintegrate. They didn't have time to learn it. Look at how long we have to educate our children to learn. And we as adults learn in a lifetime. Here, you expect people to change because they had an epiphany at Mount Sinai. People's character doesn't change that way.
Are you saying it's inborn?
What?
That their bad character is inborn?
Well, listen, these people grew up in Mitzrayim. All right? They were only in the desert for a year. And, you know, they were studying for a year in those conditions, even though everything was provided for. I think it's human nature.
Okay. You're right. You're right. I'm not knocking them. It's far from me to knock them. But the fact of the matter is, the sages are telling us that these are destructive traits. These were all events which led to tremendous destruction and decline. In this week's Parsha, the result of this complaining was a plague, was death. Both the complainers and also those that complained about the food, there was an onslaught of quail that fell, and as they were eating their fill of meat, they perished. You read about it in the Parsha. So their desire for meat or their malcontent ended in destruction. The Meraglim, the spies, their report and the reaction of the people to their report ended in 40 years wandering in the desert, such that none of the adults that had merited to leave Egypt and stand before Mount Sinai got to enter into the land of Israel. All as a result of this malcontent associated with the spies. Korach, his entire entourage, which consisted of over 250 very, very distinguished leaders, also perished in the miraculous story of the swallowing by the mouth of the earth. So clearly the Torah is telling us, whether it's our fault or not, that people have, as you say, people have these characteristics, but they're deadly and they're destructive. And so I would like to suggest that over the course of these next weeks, we come with our guide at our side, with Mesilas Yesharim, well armed, to try to tackle a little bit the subject of bad midos. And as you say, Dan, you're 100% correct. This is not a disease that they caught. This is something that we're born with. This is the evil inclination, as you say, Arthur.
You know, Rabbi,
yes.
I just thought,
please.
Here you have Yitzhak and you have Yaakov, who just studied year upon year, and they learned and they learned. And they still made many mistakes.
I don't know about many.
Well, no,
but yeah.
I mean, from the standard, from the high standard.
Yes, okay, good. Okay, good qualification.
And yet, the people, even I can imagine the epiphany of Mount Sinai, at Har Sinai, it just, you may not get it.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were scared at Har Sinai. They only heard the voice of Hashem twice. And they got so scared from the intensity that Moshe had to say the rest.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, for me, the expectation that people will change so immediately. I mean, granted, what they did were bad things.
Mm-hmm.
But I keep thinking of human nature.
Dan used the word epiphany. Last week, I don't think you were here, but we discussed the word epiphany because I asked the rabbi, would the experience of confronting Hashem face to face 600,000 multitude be called an epiphany? And I think the agreement was no, it's not. It wasn't in the modern context what we think of as an epiphany. So maybe characterizing it as an epiphany.
Well, I remember we had this conversation, and I think I made a comment after class that an epiphany, in the sense of a new realization, maybe you could call it, but does an epiphany mean that you change?
No.
I don't think there is an expectation that the people could change. If, in fact, we have these inborn midos, these character flaws, because God made us that way, I don't think that there is an expectation to change because of an event. Perhaps what we can gain from Matan Torah is that we become aware of our nature and we accept the Torah as a tool or a system that will help us deal with it and slowly over time overcome our nature.
It's like the difference between realization and revelation. I think what happened at Sinai was an experience, mm-hmm. more than just the epiphany. To me, is kind of a realization.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a Jewish word, but kind of a realization. But revelation is life transforming, I think, or can be.
Even if it's life transforming, I'll grant you that we now have a new way of looking at things. When somebody goes through, let's say, a life-threatening experience and survives it, they may think differently from now on in terms of their appreciation, in terms of what's important in life. But overcoming inborn character traits, and we have to really get into it to see what we're talking about, is something that's a lifetime of work. It cannot be overcome with the snap of a finger. But the question is, do we recognize what these midos are and what the source is? The Mesilas Yesharim is a wonderful place to look if you would like to discover the nature that really lies within each and every one of us. So I'd like to start this conversation by really making a introductory comment on our wonderful companion sefer this year, the Mesilas Yesharim, something that recently occurred to me as we were studying in a different group. In the first chapter on page 8, which is entitled Man's Duty in His World, Rabbi Luzzatto opens with famous words, Yisod ha-chassidus v'shoresh v'avoda ha-tmimahu shi-yisborer v'yisameis eitzol ha-adam ma-chovaso b'olamo u-ma-tzarich shi-yasim ma-bato u-megamaso b'chol asher hu-amel kol yimei chayav. That's just one sentence. It means, the bedrock of piety and the root of flawless divine service lies in man's effort to clarify and verify what his duty is in his world. He must determine what he is aiming for and how to achieve this in all his labors throughout his lifetime. Opening sentence. Clarify, verify, effort, determine. What are you aiming for? How to achieve this? A lot of questions, a lot of inquiry, investigation. Something that's not obvious is implied here. And then he starts going off on a conversation about Olam Haba and Olam Hazeh. Our sages of blessed memory have instructed us that man was created for the sole purpose of reveling in the eternal, delighting in the splendor of the divine presence, this being the ultimate joy and the greatest of all pleasures in existence, and the true place for this pleasure is the world to come, which was created with this purpose in mind. However, the path that helps us reach our desired objective is this world. As the sages of blessed memory have said, this world resembles a corridor before the world to come. This means that the means that lead man to this goal are the mitzvos, that the eternal, may his name be blessed, commanded us to observe, and the place for doing the mitzvos is in this world alone. So, the standard, if you will, the standard presentation, we're in this world to do mitzvos, our goal is to earn life in the world to come, the eternal world, where there is no more performance, there is only results and dividends. And that's basically the rest of chapter 1, how to use this world to achieve the world to come. And I'm thinking to myself, why was it necessary for him to begin with that paragraph? That man must expend effort to clarify and verify and determine and aim and achieve. Why did he have to say all that? Why didn't he just start off the chapter and say, let me tell you, what is the purpose of life? How do we achieve the world to come? Why did he have to give us this introduction of clarifying.
A person, once they have the reason to do something, must act on it. And what I hear him saying is, you have to learn the tools on how to live correctly, but you have to act what you've learned. That just knowing or thinking is insufficient.
I understand. But the first paragraph is about knowing and thinking.
Yes, but it does...
Determining, clarifying, verifying, it's all mental. Of course, acting upon it is the job of mitzvot.
Yes.
But I don't yet quite comprehend the connection between the first paragraph about this need to verify and clarify and his thesis on world to come, and this world and world to come. I don't see why, at the outset, he couldn't have just started with paragraph two. This was a critical analysis question that occurred to me as I was reading this just a few days ago. It may be a subtle question, but listen to how I resolve this for myself, and you'll understand, hopefully, why I bring this up as a prelude to our study of midos, of character traits. I believe that what Rabbi Luzzatto is trying to tell us is that the difference between somebody who's living life to serve God and one who just goes through life is that the one who goes through life accepts everything at face value, accepts the world as it seems. And how many people live life that way? They accept the world as it seems. People are the way they seem to be. And that's just accepted. Just accept that's the way we are. The world seems to have its own purpose, call it, in our society, to make a living, to embark on a career, to achieve success, to perhaps gain wealth, possession, to engage in relationships as they suit us. No, doesn't there seem to be a kind of a rhythm, a kind of a charted goal in life, which just seems to be obvious? And people act the way they act because that's the way they are, and that's just the obvious. Don't expect any different. Doesn't there seem to be a very surface level understanding of life, perhaps? What you see is what you get. I'm saying an initial reaction to things, or maybe the universal approach to life. What you see is what you get. This is it. You don't need to investigate because it's obvious. It's there before you. We've been doing it for generations. Read our history. Man has always been exploring and looking for a place to live and to set up a country or to set up a government and live in relative peace and just be able to build, put down roots and develop himself. Isn't that what life is all about? And occasionally there are conflicts between men, and occasionally there are conflicts between nations, and we have to fight until the strongest man wins. This life seems to have its own melody. And that's the way you could live your life. But if you live your life that way, you will never come to this understanding of life. I will tell you in paragraph two and on that there is a concept that this world is only a corridor. I can tell that to you until you're blue in the face. But if you don't accept that things are not the way they seem, the words will just not penetrate. I have to begin by telling you the premise of my proclamation of what is man's duty in the world. The premise is that in order to serve God and to be pious, effort is required. What kind of effort? Effort to clarify. Effort to verify what is really going on. What is the reality of the world? What is a person aiming for? It's not the obvious. How to achieve this, not the obvious, what most people think we are here to achieve. In other words, in order to accept the reality of this world and the world to come, there has to be a tearing down of the idols of man, the givens, that everything is just the way it seems. We have to tear that down. We have to realize that it's not what it seems. If we don't accept that premise, then the words fall on deaf ears. Because we say, yes, this is a corridor, but we don't really live as though this is a corridor. We don't really accept it. We live as though this is the reality. I don't want to belabor this, because we have something to do. But I do feel strongly that the study of this sefer, and indeed spiritual Torah, requires a dismantling of assumptions and a dismantling of a picture and of a view that we've all grown up with. Why do I give this introduction as a prelude to a study of Nidos? Because I think that to understand Nidos, we have to do the same thing. We also grow up with a view that we're great and that the way we are is the way we're supposed to be. And we can tweak it here and we can tweak it there. But basically, the way human beings behave is the way they're supposed to behave. It can't be different. And I say this out of personal response, personal reaction. I have always felt, hopefully you'll identify with this, because I'm speaking honestly, I've always felt that when anybody lectures about Midos, it's a little bit annoying and it's a little insulting. Because they're going to talk about how man in his nature, and I'm going to mention the five Midos, the five negative traits that Lutzato deals with in his treatise. Somebody will get up and lecture and say, man is arrogant. Gava. Man has a tendency for kas, for anger. And it shouldn't be. Man is kina, has jealousy. Chemdas ha-momon, man desires money. Chemdas ha-kavod, and above all, we'll revisit these, each one. Man desires honor. And these lecturers, whoever they may be, or these rabbis, get up and they say these things as if to say, you frail, weak man, you're filled with imperfect character traits. That's not the way you're supposed to be. And I say, what? Me? You calling me arrogant? You're calling me angry and jealous? You say that I covet money and I covet honor? My mother always told me I was great. But again, it's this tearing down of the image, of the icons, of the idols. And of course we have a problem, oh, I'm going to lose my self-esteem. Please tell me I'm okay. And the truth is, of course you're okay, because you're exactly the way God made you. But God also made us, put us in a world where the reality is beneath the surface, and we have to uncover. And when we study about negative character traits, the challenge is, become all that you can be. Yes, we are great people, we are wonderful people, but the true me is somebody who is less arrogant. The true me, the holy me, the servants of God me, is less arrogant and less angry, more patient, more accepting, less jealous, more content with what I have, less desirous of material acquisition, less caring about my honor. That's within me also. That's my potential. That's not the obvious me, but that's the real me. So let's not approach this subject with an inferiority complex. Let us listen, just as we listen to everything in Torah as coming beneath the surface, something that we had to clarify, something that we had to dig deep to discover that the reality was deeper than we thought. Let's approach Midos from the same perspective, that there's more inside of me than I realized. Inside of me, with my perfectly human, acceptable traits, there is a less arrogant me. There's a more selfless me. I am considering this class to be an introduction to the topic of Midos, which, God willing, we will spend at least the next 2 weeks on. But Rabbi Lutzato is speaking words of Mesorah, of tradition. He writes like he's a human being, but he writes like he's a human being who has dug deep to clarify and verify what secrets God in his Torah and our sages in their insight, their God-given insight, are telling us about ourselves. And it opens up a new world. Each of these five midos, he writes, demonstrate a lack of wisdom, a foolishness, a blindness, if you will. I'll try to jump around to various quotes. First of all, page 78. Cleanliness and character development. Indeed, just as cleanliness is required in one's actions, it is also required in one's character development. And in fact, it is almost more difficult to apply it to one's character development than to one's actions. It's harder to change our character than it is to adopt certain religious observances. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said, it's easier to finish the entire Shas, that means to study the 4,000 plus pages of the Talmud, than it is to change a character trait. Because it is much more inborn. It is much more a part of our nature than simply our behaviors. You can easily change your behavior, but can you change your nature?
What's your nature?
Well, we're going to learn about these five qualities. These are all hallmarks of our nature. Now, we're focusing on this. There's many great qualities that we have, too.
But the question is whether it's a good or a bad character trait. What is it? A habit?
Oh, it's a combination of nature and nurture. As a psychologist say, it's a combination of something inborn, because they all stem from self-centeredness. Think about how we were born. We were born as a baby. A baby is completely helpless, completely dependent, and completely taking. A baby is the most selfish creature in the whole world, the most inconsiderate, the most impatient, the angriest creature of the world. All the baby wants is to be served, held, fed, clothed, doesn't do anything for you, doesn't do a stitch of work around the house. That's how we were made. So again, we're not saying anybody's bad. We're perfect, because that's the way God made us. But God made us as this ball of clay, completely self-centered, and gave us a mind, and gave us a heart, and gave us instructions on how to transcend those natures and become all of the opposites. Selfless, giving, patient, compassionate,
but aren't all
humble.
These things habits?
Part of it is habits, because since that's our nature, we do it a lot.
Habits
help ingrain the natures more and more, but there are also things that we're born with, which is even before habit. It's a combination of nature and conditioning.
But I mean, they all made habits. Might not have been a habit in the beginning, it
might
have been a nature, but
okay.
You achieve habits, and
yes.
Habits can be changed. So you can get rid of bad traits by changing.
And absolutely, you can.
To good habits.
That's true. It's just very hard, but it's doable because we were taught how to do it. But we have to first recognize that this is a goal. So I just want to point out maybe how he talks about each of these habits as kind of shock us to realizing that they lack wisdom. So the underlying principle of pride, for example, the first one, is that a person has a high regard for himself, and in his heart he deems himself worthy of praise. So our first response is, what's wrong with that? It's true. Ain't it the truth? My mama said it was. Okay, but that's a very limited perspective. Does that mean that I have nothing to improve upon? Does that mean that other people don't have what to teach me? Does that mean that I realize the depth of my potential? I just heard a very interesting thing. Actually, somebody who's in the field of financial planning, a group, they have discovered through certain life experiences that there's more to financial planning than amassing and preserving wealth. And they've discovered what I call the spirituality of money. That's not the purpose of this talk, but I went to a luncheon where they explained their philosophy, how they presented to their clients, and one of the things that he said, and a lot of this is original material, of course it's found in the Torah, he said that he presented this once to a Catholic, and they said, this is wonderful, we're going to incorporate that into our Sunday school curriculum. And then he shared it with a Protestant, and the Protestant said, we're going to adopt that for our church service. And then I piped up and I said, yes, and you said it to the rabbi, and the rabbi said, hey, you stole this from my sermon. It's all in here, but it was quite. Anyway, they coined these terms. K-D-K and D-K-D-K. The letters. K, that stands for no. This is what I know. K-D-K, I know that I don't know. And then D-K-D-K, I don't know that I don't know.
Donald Rumsfeld.
Did he say that?
Yes, during the war. He said there are known knowns and none unknowns. Famous quote of his.
There are known knowns.
And then there are known unknowns. He was trying to rationalize the Iraq war effort.
But then, what about unknown unknowns? In other words, this person said that what we know, make a pie chart. What we know is a sliver. What we know that we don't know is another sliver. The vast majority of the pie we don't know that we don't know. And that's the same thing over here. There's so much about us and our potential that we don't even realize until we read the Torah. So one person may say, based on all the information I have, I am important, I have a high regard, and I'm worthy of praise. Okay, that's based on the knowns. But it's a short-sightedness. One individual may consider himself intelligent, another handsome, another esteemed, another prominent, another wise. The rule of thumb is that when a person thinks he has incorporated anything of the good things of the world, he is in immediate danger of falling into the pit of pride. And how do you see that as foolishness and lack of wisdom? Because usually those kind of thoughts lead to behaviors which are very undesirable. People start being arrogant towards others. They expect others to praise them, and they become angry if they do not receive the praise that they believe they deserve. They become indignant, and on and on. So pride is the source of foolishness. I had a quote which says this, page 82.
Pride comes before the fall.
Very good. Very good. All of these are the outgrowths of a form of pride that retards the wisdom of sages, stultifies their minds, and takes away the hearts of the eminently wise. Even those students whose training is still incomplete and whose eyes have barely been opened consider themselves equal to the greatest of the sages. Regarding all of these, it has been said, the haughty of heart are the abomination of the eternal. Okay, so here's one. Did we know this? I don't think the average person knows this. I think the average person thinks it's normal. And it is normal. It's normal, but is it the goal? Is it desirable? The same thing with kas, with anger. Kas is probably the most obvious that it's a destructive trait. Sometimes anger is born out of arrogance or out of desire, perhaps. But it's definitely a manifestation which, when allowed to flare up, also removes sensibility. Here, this is what he writes about anger. Whoever gets angry is regarded as though he is engaged in idolatry. Talmud Shabbos, he gets angry over any opposition to his will. He becomes filled with fury that he loses control emotionally. His judgment becomes muddled. A person of this nature would destroy a whole world if he were given the opportunity. He is not ruled by common sense at all, and he is literally bereft of reason, like the wild animals. And our sages teach us that this is something, a latent power that we may have within us, and teach us how we can control it. And first and foremost, by realizing that it's there. Jealousy. He laughs at jealousy. Not because it's not natural. It is natural. But if you think about it, envy, too, is no more than the result of foolishness and a lack of understanding. An envious person does not gain anything for himself. He does not cause any loss to the one he envies. He alone loses out. Envy will kill the fool.
Does the Torah make any allowances for mental illness?
Yes, yes. There is halachic classification of an extremely affected person, and then, of course, there's all kinds of recognition of the truth of where people are. The Torah says, do not be naive. Use your seichel, use your common sense. Desire for money, we only have two more. The desire for money binds a person to this world, places the shackles of labor and the pursuit of business upon him. This distracts him from the service of the eternal. Many prayers go to waste. Many mitzvos are forgotten due to excessive involvement in business and toil invested in large-scale enterprise. The desire for money exposes him to many dangers, piles up worries that sap his strength. Even very successful and wealthy people are constantly in a state of worry. Worse than this is the desire for honor. He goes on and on and on for this. A person would be able to overcome his desire for money and other enjoyments were it not for the pressure exerted upon him by the desire for honor. For he cannot endure seeing himself inferior to his peers. And then he describes all the great, great people in the Tanakh, in the scriptures, whose downfall came because of desire for honor, including Korach and the spies. These were great people, very, very great people. Shaul, King Saul. In summation, the desire for honor is what grips a person's heart more than all the worldly wants and desires. If not for this, a person would be content to eat whatever is at hand, to wear whatever would cover his nakedness, and to dwell in a house that would protect him from the elements. With this in mind, the rabbis of blessed memory have said in Pirkei Avos, envy, lust, and the pursuit of honor remove man from the world.
What about the other side of this coin, as it were, and that is avoidance of humiliation? Is that more acceptable? I mean, rank humiliation, I don't think anybody has an appetite for that, but
right.
It's kind of a natural impulse to want to avoid that.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly self-respect, dignity of man, even of himself, is certainly in order.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank God for that.
It is the basic premise that every human being has to be exposed and... See, I hear negativity before positivity, but yet... Why can't learning Musar be affirmative to someone hearing it for the first time? Rather than having to be broken, taking the levels off like an onion, why can't a person rise from the knowledge of the Musar rather than being broken down?
Good point.
I believe this class is class number 326. And I have withheld this topic from your ears all this time. You're right.
Well, no, you're
I would not give an outreach lecture on this topic.
No, you're presenting it very well. I'm just saying the concept, though, to me, I immediately, were talking...
I told you I react that
bringing
way.
Down, ooh. My first response was, when I heard Musa for the first time, why couldn't I be elevated?
Yeah. And I have found Musa to be elevating, and I have sought in my teaching to be very elevating. But there are certain, you know, you got to, listen, if you're a doctor, sometimes you got to tell the patients what they don't want to hear.
Of course.
But let me respond to you.
Am I getting it wrong?
I have to close. No, you're not getting it wrong. It should be a little bit bruising to our egos. It should be. It's natural, and you're taking it like healthy men and women, but it's bruising. But it's no different than anything else in the spiritual world. Just like we find it foreign to be told that this world is only a corridor to the world to come, and we're really here just to do mitzvah so that we can really get to the real world. It's foreign. It's not the obvious. The obvious is quite to the contrary. So that's why I prefaced it by saying, if we want to dig into any kind of Musar, we have to be open to the idea that God's reality is not the way it seems. What you see is what you get. What you see is what you get is that we're perfect and no need to change. And the reality is that there's so much more inside of us that is beneath the surface. I believe that Mussar should not be depressing, and that a person should not be averse to accepting these ideas, because recognizing that God made us this way and recognizing that we can elevate ourselves, I think it's the most empowering and elevating thought. But let me close with this, because time is closing, and God willing, we will continue our discussion of Midos in the coming weeks. I think that I may be responding to what you're saying. What's the best way to learn Midos? I have found Rabbi Luzzatto says you've got to learn Mussar, you've got to study works like this, and you have to constantly review them, because being that these are not obvious to us, we forget them all the time. And I agree with that. I have found that the greatest way to learn good Midos and how these actual negative traits can be minimized is by watching pious people who have themselves lived and embodied this. And when you see someone like that, when you see somebody who does not have an air of arrogance, an older person, a very wise person, who does not walk around as though the world should be bowing to his feet, but rather stoops to speak to any child, man or woman, in the most self-effacing way, with tremendous self-respect and tremendous dignity and grace, you just know it when you see it. And somebody who, when things go against their will, they don't get angry, they're patient, they let it roll off. And people who are very happy about who they are and what they have, do not show envy, and are happy with living a life of modesty, and don't walk around looking for honor. When you see it, that's how you can recognize it. And when you see people like that, then it becomes something that's very uplifting and something that's doable, something that it just like ignites a fire within ourselves. If you see it, you can become it a lot easier. So I think that that is a constant, whether we're talking about knowledge, you know, when you're around a person that contains knowledge, it's contagious. The knowledge just shares. It's true about observance. When you're around people that are observant, it makes you want to be observant. And the same thing is true, and maybe even more so, when you see the embodiment of good Midos. It just spills over.
I mean, defeating these character flaws is a lifelong struggle. In my case, it is. It's a struggle every day. Is it a struggle for somebody that has achieved piety?
Is it a struggle to maintain it? I would say that it becomes easier. It was a struggle. There's a famous midrash that Moshe Rabbeinu, I don't remember the details of how it goes, but there was some portrait. And when you looked at this portrait, you saw somehow, you saw bad Midos. And somebody showed this portrait to Moshe Rabbeinu and said, "Who is this man in the portrait? We don't recognize him." And he said, "Oh, that's a portrait of me." And everyone said, "You don't look like that."
That's wonderful.
He says, "Oh, that's what I look like inside. But I have worked on my character. And the result is what you see now. This is what I did look like inside." I should say that different people have different, even natural inclinations towards trait. There's certainly a person who struggles more with arrogance than another person. There are differences even in our inborn makeup. But nobody is born without the need to work on character development. Nobody. And the mark of a great person is a person who has recognized that this is how God made us, has not been put off by that, and has not lost his self-esteem, and has not given in to denial or depression, and works on it. And I say that the greatest teacher is just observing somebody. And when you see it, you'll believe it. You'll believe that it's possible. You'll believe that negative traits is not what you see is what you get. That's not the way people were meant to be. That's the way we will be if left untouched. But we will discover the tremendous potentials that we have.
And you'll see the joy that they radiate by being in their presence.
Yeah.
I met Miriam Feldman's father once, Rabbi Weinberg. I mean, it's like, what a presence.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I never met him. I only one time.
One time, really?
And wow. Just, yeah, I had that reaction.
Mm-hmm.
Just his presence.
Mm-hmm.
You studied under him.
Mm-hmm. You must have seen him on visits to Atlanta?
No, never.
Never.
No, but during my Shiva, Rabbi Alon visited my home. And I had a book on mourning. And I showed it to him. And there was an invocation in it from Baltimore Shiva. And he went to, that's my father-in-law. You know.
Rabbi Drucker's book.
I believe so.
Yeah.
I feel that way about several of the rabbis in our very lucky in our
absolutely
community.
That's what I was responding to.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think I would have that reaction to meeting the Dalai Lama. I'm serious. Because what I've read of his and when I've seen him, he's just, to me, he's spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
I felt Rabbi Weinberg was spiritual. You know, and just. And I had a 5-minute talk with him privately, just walking. And I was very moved.
Hmm.
My grandson, Yitzhak, took a special trip to Boston, and he met the Boston Rebbe.
Mm.
I don't know the gentleman's name, but he came back all aglow.
Mm.
That,
mm-hmm.
It was such a
mm-hmm.
special experience.
Mm-hmm.
Our lives are enriched by meeting people like that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You meet them periodically. I met several, I think, at the Kotel. And not everybody, but once in a while a rabbi will come up and I'll sort of engage with him a little bit in conversation. And there's just something about
it. You said that you were standing at the Kotel and you saw a man davening so hard that you wanted to touch him.
Yes. Wow. Yeah. Yeah, that's what I mean. Anyway. Well,
thank you for sharing lunch with me.
No.
Thanks for the learning.
Thank you so much. You're the best.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you,
gentlemen. Have a great, good Shabbos.
Have a good Shabbos. Be well.
Scott.
Have a good Shabbos.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.